Welcome to the NutriTots podcast. We're your hosts, Megan and Haley Arnold. As clinicians and moms, we are in the trenches with you dealing with the fun and sometimes ugly truth of growing a healthy family. Our goal is to empower a community through nutrition. Join us as we dive into topics related to conception, pregnancy, and raising kids. Thanks for listening. We're excited to have you with us.
Welcome to the NutriTots podcast, everyone. My name is Dr. Haley Arnold, and with me we have obviously Dr. Megan Arnold and our absolute favorite scientist on the planet, Dr. Sarah Ballantyne, who's the creator of thepaleomom.com and Nutrivore.com. Welcome to the show, Sarah.
I mean, any excuse to just like hang out with my besties, come on.
That's true. I mean, we would hop on here just to chat in general anyway.
Yeah. We might have a different beverage beside us if we were hopping on just to chat in general. I'm only drinking green tea right now, but yeah.
Well, welcome to our podcast. We're excited. We have, we're newly launching this particular podcast to talk to all of our parents, all of our kiddos, and the people who really love to learn about nutrition. And we figured who better to interview than you?
I may be the biggest nutrition nerd in the planet right now.
I think you outrank us for sure.
Well, let's test that hypothesis. Let's get nerdy.
All right. Well, then let's dive in. All right. Yeah.
Tell us about Nutrivore.
So the concept of Nutrivore is really simple, right? The idea is to choose foods so that the sum total of all the nutrients those foods contain throughout the day add up to meet our nutritional needs. And what I love about this very simple idea is that there's a million ways to do it, right? It's not diet specific. There's no yes foods and no foods. Like, as long as there are some nutrient dense foods in the diet that are, you know, really like those powerhouse foods that supply a large chunk of all of those essential vitamins and minerals and phytonutrients and essential amino acids and essential fatty acids that we need, the more of those that we have, the more room there is for some, we'll call them quality of life foods, right? Foods that are not nutritionally amazing, but are deliciously amazing. Therefore, we want to eat them. And you can layer the Nutrivore philosophy atop of most dietary templates. There's only a few like fad diets that are not compatible because they're diets that eliminate all food sources of essential nutrients. So there's no way to get all of the nutrients you need if you cut out every single food source of, you know, phytonutrients, for example,
or like things like the carnivore diet,
like carnivore, like fruitarian, like vegan is obviously like most implementations of a vegan diet would make full nutrient sufficiency very, very challenging. Most implementations of a keto diet would make a Nutrivore philosophy very, very challenging. So if anybody listening is following any of those diets, first thing to do is actually read more about them, because they all have this really not cool like cost benefit analysis. Like the cost for the purported benefit, most of the purported benefits are not supported by scientific evidence, and there is a big cost to most of those diets, nutrient deficiencies being just one of many. Sure. So first read more about it and see if that's really the right thing for you. And if it is, work with a practitioner to make sure you're supplementing the shortfalls. Like, make sure that you're working with someone, they're monitoring you for the like known higher possibility adverse effects, right? Some of these impact heart health, some of them impact gastrointestinal health. Like, you want to know that if you're going to be following one of these diets for whatever your priorities are, and then work with a practitioner to make sure that you're getting supplements are not as good as whole food. The nutrients are not as well absorbed. They tend not to be as bioavailable, but it's better than nothing. So work with a practitioner to make sure that you're addressing any of those shortfalls.
Sure. Yeah. That's where we come in.
Yeah.
So you're telling me, sorry, I cut you off, Megan. You're telling me that if I could physically handle it, I could still have like gluten.
You could eat a donut and still, yeah, like if you're
not so bad about myself,
a bag of hot Cheetos wrapped with kale.
That's got to have a really high Nutrivore score right there.
Yeah. The kale especially is definitely the contributor. Yeah. So that's what I like about Nutrivore as a, again, sort of like philosophy rather than a diet itself, is that it gets us away from demonizing certain foods, of having good foods and bad foods, yes foods and no foods. And it really like breaks away from the harm that diet culture has done to like public health in general over the last 50 years. I think in this like search for an increasingly unhealthy body type, we are driving a larger and larger proportion of society into these like yo-yo diet patterns, which we know harm metabolism and then, you know, harm our mental health in addition to our physical health. It's contributing to things like insulin resistance. And what's happening with the rise of these increasingly restrictive fad diets is we're actually like layering now all of these nutrient deficiencies on top of the problem, which is then harming our health. So most of us don't want to trade poor health for a beach bod.
Right.
And the problem is that the beach bod is like increasingly hard to achieve on these yo-yo diets because of the harm to our metabolisms. It's tanking our basal metabolic rates. So we're having to cut calories more and more and more in order to lose weight, which means our, you know, as soon as our ghrelin basically says, no, this is not cool, like our hunger is increasing the whole time, then our bodies are primed. Like we're metabolically programmed to not want to be that thin, to not want to live with that level of food restriction. And so we're fighting our own biochemistry. And then when we can't fight it anymore, our bodies have basically set the chemistry to put weight on really, really rapidly. And so the net result of diet culture is a less healthy society. So Nutrivore is taking a step back from that. Like, let's get away from saying that you're a horrible person if you ever eat a donut or pizza. Like, let's look at the quality of the diet as a whole. Are your nutritional needs met by the foods that you're eating? Yes. Are you feeling great? Yes. Great. You're doing a great job. Like, there's lifestyle priorities too that are important. But unless, you know, like, there's still food sensitivities, that's still a thing. Like, right. I'm never going to be able to eat pizza. That is 100% ingredients that don't work for my body. Especially the crust, the tomato sauce, and the cheese, which I would argue, you know, is the pizza. That's pretty much the whole thing. But that's my body, and I get to know my body still. So Nutrivore doesn't take away the value of eliminations and like that exploration of food sensitivities for us as individuals, but it does take a sidestep from then me saying, just because pizza doesn't work for me, pizza's terrible, bad, it's evil, sure. Right? Like, we're going to take away the judgment of food.
Well, and I appreciate that you said it kind of gets us away from the diet culture aspect, because obviously right now, you know, we're in in our world anyways, we're in a big shift towards an anti-diet culture.
Yeah.
But one of the things we always tell our patients is you can't enjoy society or enjoy life cycle events without food. I mean, food just makes it fun. And our rule is always, if it's not going to kill you immediately, or if you have sensitivities to it that you're going to pay repercussions for, love it, bless it, eat it, and move on.
I really love where the sort of body positivity and anti-diet movement are going with removing judgment from food, removing the guilt associated with indulging. And I think the guilt cycle is part of why cheating, I'm using air quotes, which no one can tell on a podcast, but it's why when you cheat, you can fall down this, like, you basically fall off the wagon of whatever your dietary priorities were. And so if we get away from that guilt cycle, get away from even thinking of it as a cheat, then it's a lot easier to have an indulgence and still overall make good choices the rest of the time. But I think one of the things that I would like to see more prevalent in the body positivity movement, which I identify with very strongly, is an understanding that it still doesn't matter what you eat. Like healthy food is still healthy food, and eating intuitively is really hard if you're eating hyper palatable foods that override satiety signals, because then you don't even know if you're full. Then you're driving cravings.
All day if I could.
Yes. They're delicious, but it's important to understand what they're doing to our brain chemistry, to our gastrointestinal hormones, to our gut microbiomes. And I think there is a way of balancing, like knowing what healthy foods are, eating a predominantly whole foods diet, focusing on nutrient density, and still embracing the room for, you know, some empty calories, and not feeling like we need to judge ourselves, not feeling that we were bad for eating those things, or that we're, you know, somehow harming our health. Because if we look at the whole diet and we're predominantly choosing healthy foods, then I don't think we need to feel guilty about, again, the cookies or the muffins or the whatevers. But at the same time, I feel like eating intuitively, when we're just saying, I'm just going to eat what I feel like eating, however much of it I feel like eating, doesn't work when we're choosing foods that actually interfere with our body being able to tell us what it wants.
Fair. I mean, intuitive eating, I appreciate it for the concept.
Well, emotional eating can tap into that too. It's like intuitively, when I'm depressed, Ben and Jerry seems like a wonderful idea.
Do you want to know something that's really, really cool about like stress eating? So they've done these studies in rodents, and rodents exhibit a lot of outward behaviors of stress, like barbering, where they like rip out all their own hair. So you can like look at a mouse and know that it's exhibiting signs of stress without even testing cortisol and all of the actual like biochemical markers of stress. So they've done studies where they've been measuring stress behaviors in mice, and they've either, they stress them out in different ways. We don't need to get into that. But then they either like restrict their food intake, or they let them eat as much as they want. And then they'll also have a group that has options to eat particularly calorie dense foods, right? High fat, high sugar foods, which tend to be the things that we crave when we're under stress. And what those studies show is that when the mice have access to the calorie dense foods, it actually reduces their stress behaviors. It's protective against the stress, like maladaptations. The obvious problem with that is chronic stress. And when the stress never goes away and you're eating those like super calorie dense foods all the time, then you're starting to hurt your, you know, insulin sensitivity, like that then adds up. But there is a reason why we crave those foods. It's actually neuroprotective in the short term.
So if we're not experiencing chronic stress, which to be fair, I don't know anyone who isn't. If we, let's say we're, you know, in a perfect world, we're eating our fruits and veggies and lean proteins most days, but on Saturday night, something happens and we just go for a pint of ice cream, that's not necessarily going to be long-term problematic. It may actually be neuroprotective.
Yes.
Interesting.
So again, I mean, the most important point is what you just said, is that most of us are under chronic stress and don't make enough time in our life for resilience activities, and aren't actively identifying what sources of stress can be, you know, addressed. What can we say no to? What can we take off our plate? What can we decide we don't care about? And what can we do to protect ourselves from stress, right? Get enough sleep, be active, eat a nutrient-dense diet. Actually, there's some nutrients that, especially omega-3 fats and vitamin C, that if we're not consuming enough of them, it magnifies the stress response. So it's another way that food and stress are kind of intertwined. But, you know, most of us could be doing better to manage our stress. Rather than just giving us all permission to eat a pint of ice cream whenever we feel stressed, I think it's important to, you know, make sure that we're all aware that we we can make changes in our lives to improve our resilience to stress and overall lower our stress levels. And that before we give ourselves permission to always eat the pint of ice cream when we feel stressed, the other things like
recognize
nature walks and mindfulness and prioritizing sleep and activity are all also high priorities.
Fair. I'm down with that.
Okay. So with this concept of nutrivore and the grading scale, how do you think it would work for parents to utilize that concept with their children's diet?
I mean, I think it really emphasizes the importance of whole foods. It emphasizes the importance of fresh fruits and vegetables. It emphasizes the importance of seafood. And I think that as parents, like one of the things that I hear, because I had one child who was borderline failure to thrive and was incredibly picky. She had sensory processing disorder, which we didn't know at the time, but it was making it so that she had strong aversions to flavors, temperatures, and textures, of which is like the entire experience of food. And so, you know, we had a really hard time with her until she was probably like 7 or 8. And actually we started working on nutrition with her when she was 5, and improving her nutrition did make a really big difference to her symptoms of sensory processing disorder. But it was kind of like, we also were doing occupational therapy. Like it was a really holistic approach. And so when I say, yeah, like get your kids to eat lots of vegetables and fish, I know that most parents are like,
whatever.
How? Whatever. So I think it's actually like, I think what foods to focus on is not a surprise, right? Some quality proteins, lots of vegetables. Fruit is fantastic, and kids have a higher carbohydrate need than adults do. So, you know, I don't think there's a reason to limit how much fruit our kids are eating. Ideally, they would eat a variety of fruit, and it's not just 6 bananas in a day. But, you know, it's also important to recognize that there are a couple of different picky phases that are developmentally appropriate, and we can sort of nurture our kids through those. But there's some really interesting psychology research looking at how kids learn healthy eating patterns and how they learn to like foods, right? So it's how do I get my kid to eat Brussels sprouts? So a couple of the most important factors, one is food familiarity. So actually we had a 1-bite rule for years and years and years. And then the 1-bite rule became a 2-bite rule, and the 2-bite rule became a 6-bite rule, like as my kids got bigger. But that knowing what that's gonna taste like and what the texture experience is gonna be like, just having an expectation of what I'm about to eat, this works in adults too, by the way, is really, really important for developing flavor preferences. And then positive experiences is really important. So yelling at our kids to eat a bite of vegetables is not gonna develop a positive association with that bite of vegetables. What will is lots of encouragement, you know, cheering or a reward, right? You get to eat your 1 Brussels sprout, and then you get to have the strawberries that you want. We did a lot of, because my husband and I are professional improvisers just on the side. We do improv comedy. And so we would do a lot of like games around the dinner table that were like improv games, like making up a story 1 word at a time, going around the table with the 4 of us, which was hilarious whenever it got to the like 2 or 3-year-old's turn. It would definitely turn the story into a strange direction all of a sudden. But we did a lot of like fun games like that around mealtimes. And that I think really made a big difference. And then the last thing is like just being a good example. So if we're expecting our kids to eat Brussels sprouts and we're not eating the Brussels sprouts ourselves, kids are really good at picking up hypocrisy in general. So good experiences, familiarity, which just means keep doing it, don't need to force it, and good role models. And also, So there is this really cool study where they took little kids who hated Brussels sprouts, and they gave them either plain Brussels sprouts with cream cheese, which I'm not sure is the most natural flavor combination. Or even more interesting, Brussels sprouts with sweetened cream cheese. So sweetened cream cheese would taste like cheesecake, right? That's pretty much what cheesecake is.
You can't see me, but I'm taking a grace.
I've never seen a slice of cheesecake drizzled with Brussels sprouts.
No. It's definitely not the flavor combination that I would go to, but the kids obviously really gravitated to the sweet flavor. And so the kids who got the Brussels sprouts with the sweetened cream cheese developed a preference for Brussels sprouts at a much higher level than any of the other groups. And so another way that we can get our kids to develop these flavor preferences is pairing a food with something that the kid really likes. This is why like ketchup kids are so easy, because you could just put ketchup on their plate and they'll dip anything in ketchup. So if you have a ketchup kid, like, embrace it. That's awesome. But sometimes kids, you know, this is ranch dressing can sometimes do this, right? That kids will eat anything. Obviously I would recommend an organic ketchup that doesn't have high fructose corn syrup in it, and a ranch dressing that's made with healthy fats like olive oil or avocado oil. But also, like, don't be afraid to have your kids have a weird combination. They love bananas. Serve some bananas and Brussels sprouts mixed together. It's not any weirder than Brussels sprouts with sweetened cream cheese.
We got he's now three, but when he was two, we got our two-year-old to try asparagus by cutting it into circles. You just cut the asparagus down the stalk, right? But
yeah,
he was learning all of his shapes at the time, and he loves apples, so he'll eat an apple all day long. But Megan put the asparagus circle on the bite of apple, and then he ate all the asparagus afterwards. So,
and does he eat asparagus whole now?
I mean, he's not a picky eater, so that's not the best example. But our daughter is, and so she's the ketchup girl. So she'll dip her banana in ketchup. It's disgusting.
I mean, but she loves it.
She loves it.
She loves it. And I think as parents, letting go of what we think should taste good.
That's very
hard. And just embracing however our kids are going to eat those healthy foods. I am not opposed to hiding vegetables in a brownie or smoothies or you know, adding them to scrambled eggs. We used to make green eggs. So I would blend eggs with spinach in the blender and then just scramble them. And it turns them this vibrant, vibrant green.
That's a good idea.
And we would do like, nobody liked ham. So it would be like green eggs and bacon instead of green eggs and ham. But then it was like green eggs. And it was something we would make for like breakfast for dinner night. Like, you know, I was loading the spinach into those eggs. It was probably more than half spinach. And so I think, yeah, you know, finding creative ways, or I used to make anything that you can turn anything that's a good smoothie will make a good popsicle. Yeah. So getting a popsicle mold and putting whatever the packing, all the hidden things into the smoothies. And we used to make them, we called them greensicles because they were green, because they were full of like kale and spinach, but you just had enough like banana and orange and mango and those sort of sweet flavors on top of it. We could add some collagen protein to that. We'd have enough sweet flavors on top of it. You didn't really taste whatever was making it green, but it would color the popsicle green. And we just called them greensicles, and we kind of made it, you know, we made it a fun thing. Like there's little freezer pops that are green. So, and they're green with food coloring and high fructose corn syrup. So why not make it green with something nutritious?
Right.
I think that's one of the things with kids too. It's, you know, most people think they're just averse to eating anything green, but if you call it something, or if you add honey or a sweetness to it, they're going to eat it. They don't, if you get them early enough, I would say they don't necessarily care that it's green.
And it doesn't have to be a lot of sweetness.
They've never had a green thing at 12 years old. They may be a little bit more likely to not.
Yeah. They might be more, I think kids, once they get into that sort of tween phase, they start to sort of make parts of their identity the things that they like or don't like, right? So it's part of their identity that they don't eat green things. But guess what? there's lots of healthy vegetables that aren't green.
Yeah.
So, you know, let's work with what we can start with, right? So cauliflower or carrots or maybe they'll like white asparagus if they don't like green asparagus, right? Like playing around with the other vegetables that we have. Like, I think it's okay to meet our kids where they are too. One of the things that I did as a parent for my kids was I always made a vegetable that they liked. And there was a phase where that vegetable was always broccoli or green beans steamed, like not roasted, not like cooked in any fun way, but just steamed broccoli or steamed green beans, both of which I can't stand now because we ate them so much. But they were the two vegetables my kids would always eat without complaining. And then I would make the vegetable for the grownups that my husband and I would have, the asparagus or the Brussels sprouts, and they would get one, right? One spear of asparagus, so that they would have that exposure to the flavor. But then they would get to fill up on the vegetable that they really liked. And I could make a big batch of green beans and it would last a couple of nights. Like, I didn't necessarily need to cook them something special every single night. And that was how we got them to eat salad and Brussels. Like, they love Brussels sprouts now. They love asparagus. They love salads. Like, salads was probably the last thing I could get them to eat and be happy about it in terms of like healthy vegetables. And there's still some things that we're working on, like beets. I don't know why I'm the only person in my house that likes beets. I think beets are delicious, but,
kind of tastes like dirt sometimes.
That's the betalains, which are the phytonutrients responsible for beets' distinctive flavor and color, that are incredibly and powerful antioxidant, anti-inflammatory phytonutrients that, some of their strongest effects are cardioprotective. So they reduce blood pressure, they reduce LDL, cholesterol, and triglycerides, and they improve vascular endothelial function. But there's also some studies showing they're neuroprotective and can potentially reverse neurodegenerative disease. So there's been a couple of studies in Alzheimer's where they give people beet juice and they actually improve cognitive function. So beets are pretty amazing, and you can't get betalains in very many foods. The only other food sources are dragon fruit, prickly pear, chard, and amaranth, and that's it. And it turns out that the metabolic pathway that makes anthocyanins, which is the main phytonutrient that makes things have red or purple colors, is mutually exclusive with betalains. So there's no anthocyanins in beets, and there's no betalains in like purple cabbage, even though...
You can't just have like dark cherries or purple cabbage and expect
those are fantastic because they have anthocyanins, which are still really beneficial polyphenols, but they're not betalains. And betalains are pretty magical, wonderful phytonutrients.
Well, that's interesting. Okay. So
am I winning the nutrition nerd title yet?
Oh, totally.
Cool. Yeah. Cool. I just wanted to make sure we just had a check in on nutrition nerd.
There was no doubt status here. okay. So You have definitely kind of answered all of our thoughts for the picky eaters and what to do, because that's a large portion of our clientele is a parent with a picky eater. And, you know, personally, all three of us here have had kids with picky
eaters. I've been there. Yeah. Or are there. Yeah.
Still there. But let me ask you this. So when it comes to conception, pregnancy, postnatal care, and Nutrivore, are you breaking down any of the Nutrivore framework to suit those specific types of categories?
So some of the resources that I've been building for Nutrivore, they're more about right now. So I developed a new nutrient profiling method. So I originally planned on just figuring out what was the best nutrient profiling method in the scientific literature and using that. And I spent like 3 months reading every nutrient profiling paper that had ever been published. And I didn't like any of the nutrient profiling methods. I thought they all had really obvious flaws. So I ended up developing my own. It's based on the Nutrient Rich Foods Index, but instead of using 9 nutrients in the calculation, it uses 33. And one of those 33 is what I call a bonus nutrient. So it's the whatever nutrient gives it the most credit out of about 10 options currently, and eventually that should get expanded to include another 10 or 15 different nutrients. And,
and then 42.
Yes, you could call it 42, except one is like the best of 10. And part of that is because there's limited nutrient data on a lot of different foods. So if you actually just include all of those nutrients, you unnecessarily penalize foods that haven't been studied as thoroughly, because there's certain foods, right? Like broccoli and Brussels sprouts, right? The cruciferous vegetables that we've just got so much data on. And then there's other foods that are still like important, like carrots or celery, that there's much more limited data, nutrition data available for. So trying to strike that balance between giving foods as much credit as we can, while recognizing that some foods might be unnecessarily penalized just because scientists don't find them very exciting. So we developed this database. We've got Nutrifor scores of about 7,500 foods. And I've also done really granular food group analysis. So really looking at like the individual vegetable and fruit families, right? Looking at fish separately from shellfish, or red meat separately from poultry, separately from eggs, separately from broth, separately from offal, and really just trying to understand what the most nutrient dense foods are. So that's about understanding what foods are the best choices that buy us the most wiggle room for the donut later. And it's not the reference values that are used in that calculation are the daily values, which are basically they're calculated as like the highest recommended daily intake for any demographic other than pregnant and lactating women, right? Like, because our nutrient needs go higher, but that's the same daily value that's on a food label. Like that's how those are calculated. So that set is the reference intake just for context in the calculation. So it's not, so it's milligrams of that nutrient relative to how much our body actually needs. So that entire nutrient profiling method is just about understanding the inherent nutritive value of different foods. And it's not about understanding what our bodies need. Like from there, when, pregnant and lactating women obviously have a higher need for calories in general, but also a variety of vitamins and minerals. Yes. And we can use the Nutrifor score to be able to identify which foods are going to provide that. We also have like detailed nutrient tables that are way more detailed than anything you get on a food package to be able to identify like what are going to be your best sources of folate during pregnancy, for example, which is so important. And so the Nutrifor resources that I focused on now are much more like the foundational stuff about just helping us understand which foods are good and which foods are maybe their reputation is not well deserved. Actually, when we look at the numbers, there are a bunch of those. Okay. Like whole grains are so nutritionally underwhelming and so calorically dense. As somebody who sort of came from the paleo diet, I felt a little vindicated in seeing that math play out. But at the same time, we'll still see dietary recommendations that say whole grains and dairy products being the lowest nutrient density animal foods. You get way more bang for your buck by choosing vegetables and fruit over whole grains. Mm-hmm. But again, the donut could still, that's not even whole grains. That's refined grains. The donut could still find its way onto your plate and you could still achieve nutrient sufficiency and get all the nutrients your body needs throughout the day, right? It's basically about, how many of these like super powerhouse foods, how much kale and liver and oysters I choose throughout the day that buys me more wiggle room for the quality of life foods. So the resources I've created so far are not specific to the person eating the food. They're specific to the food, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Okay. So if we specifically have a patient who is pregnant or trying to conceive, we can still take your framework and educate them on here's the nutrient dense foods. And then knowing that person individually, we say, okay, we're going to up it to X number of calories, X number of.
Yeah. Then you whatever can still add nutrition tracking on top of that. Right. So yeah. You would just like you would have that client you know, do a food journal, probably in an app that was giving you really good micronutrient analysis, like MyFitnessPal or Chronometer. Mm-hmm. You would set your targets based on pregnancy status in that app. And then what the Nutrivore resources would do is help that person basically choose foods that are going to get them to their targets faster.
That's awesome. And so I'm guessing it's a very similar idea because, you know, you're well known for the autoimmune protocol, paleo style diets, that kind of stuff. We can, if we have an autoimmune patient or a chronically ill patient, we can still say, here are the resources for Nutrivore, but we can do the elimination aspect as well. So maybe yeah. they can't have nightshade vegetables because they have joint pain with them, but we could increase.
But here's the other sources of lycopene and lutein, right? Yeah. Like that. What's nice about the autoimmune protocol is, I mean, the concept of nutrient density, I built into that protocol in 2012.
Yeah, this is does not feel new for you.
Yeah. So the autoimmune protocol already focuses on nutrient density. It's already a plant forward approach. It's already, you know, balanced macronutrients. It's not low or high carb or fat or protein. That being said, there are a couple of nutrients that require a little bit more intention to hit the daily value of on the autoimmune protocol, most notably calcium and vitamin E. And it's completely doable, but it takes a little bit of awareness of which foods are supplying those nutrients in order to make sure you're getting enough. But that's two nutrients on the autoimmune protocol compared to most other diets, which would have common deficiencies of 10 to 20 nutrients. So the AIP only having sort of two that are sort of commonly yeah. harder to get is still vastly superior to most other dietary templates.
I feel just anecdotally that those are kind of hard to get regardless, because whenever we do micronutrient testing or anything on our patients, those calcium and vitamin E are almost always deficient.
Yeah. Well, and also our calcium levels, if you're measuring it in blood, that's more related to our vitamin D and vitamin K intake than our calcium intake per se. Although obviously if we're not eating enough calcium, our levels can be low just because of that. Vitamin E is interesting because the foods that are like the best sources of vitamin E are all of those like fatty plant foods, right? Like mm-hmm. olives, avocados, right? Olive oil, but only a extra virgin olive oil. If you refine it, it has like 1/500th of the vitamin E content compared to a really high quality extra virgin olive oil, nuts and seeds, which is funny because I think there's, especially again, sort of like coming from the paleo diet, there is a habit of like way overdoing nuts and seeds, of like buying the 5-pound bag of almonds at Costco and eating them in a week. On the AIP, or not at the AIP, obviously nuts and seeds are not on the AIP, on the paleo diet. And I think it comes from like, that is the one of the more palatable foods that are allowed, right? And so when people are first adopting a paleo diet, going way nuts on nuts is pretty common. And studies show that basically about like an ounce a day has pretty huge health benefits. Mm-hmm. But beyond that, we don't get more benefits. And it's probably the benefits we're getting is the mineral content, the fiber, and the vitamin E as one of our best food sources of vitamin E. Like one of the best, most concentrated sources of vitamin E is sunflower seeds. But probably the more than that is the fact that then the caloric intake is starting to creep up, right? We just have inflammation if we eat too many calories, period, even if those calories come from good foods. Mm-hmm. And probably the fact that most nuts and seeds are pretty high in omega-6 fats. So it's probably this slightly more inflammatory omega-6 fats yeah. that starts to be too much and start to be a problem as well. But yeah, I would say our best sources of vitamin E in just like the food supply in general are foods that are expensive and not that common, right? Like I know avocado toast is a meme, but I don't think that many people are actually eating avocado toast for breakfast.
I eat it like once a year.
And is it slightly disappointing every time? I always feel like.
Not if I do a really good egg on it and very specific salt. So.
But go to the work.
Yeah. It takes effort for sure. All right. So this has been a wealth of information and I truly appreciate you sharing it with us. But we also want to mention that you are in a bit of a campaign.
Campaign is the nicest way to put.
That's the nicest.
The most stressful, crazy event of my professional life. Yeah.
Well, we want to make sure that all of our listeners get those resources. So what do we need to do for you, Dr. Sarah Valentine?
So let me give you the like elevator pitch of what's going on. So I have been building my first website, thepaleomom.com, for 10 and a half years and have over the last 2 years been building nutrivore.com. And the original plan was it was going to be ready to launch this fall. On May 14th, somebody else was attacked with ransomware. They used the same like cloud environment as I did. So they were serviced by the same data centers. And the hacker, just a mean hacker. Again, don't know who the person who was actually attacked was, don't know who the hacker was, brought in their attack and ended up shutting down all of 365 data centers, the data center that I use, Northeast data centers. And it just so happened that my primary systems were at one data center and my backups were at another. So very unlucky, like other people who had their primary systems impacted, but had their backups somewhere else, were able to restore their websites really quickly. But I basically lost all of my website data in a minute. It's secure, it's encrypted, it's still intact, but it's inaccessible. It's basically being held hostage. And whoever was attacked has not, here's the technical language that 365 data centers have given me, has not resolved the attack. My interpretation of that is that they have not paid the ransom or have somehow been prevented from paying the ransom. There's obviously other situations where someone else might've told them they're not allowed to. And because of that, my data is stuck on a server somewhere inaccessible. So because, you know, hundreds of thousands of people use my website for science-backed health information. I have a medical research background. This nerdiness doesn't come from nowhere. And so, you know, because it's my source of revenue, I have a team of seven amazing women to pay who are helping me build Nutrivore. But we're also like, the plan was always to keep the Paleo Mom going too, because it's such a in-depth comprehensive resource for the community. Absolutely. Not one that's never really been well represented by its name. Like the Paleo Mom makes it sound like such a like mommy blog, but it's really a science blog with lots of good resources for families too. But what we're doing is we're rebuilding the site. So we have basically, we spent the first few weeks tracking down all of the content, and very fantastically, we have it all. I was very pleased to find out that everyone on my team are also file hoarders. So we all have all of the files, which is amazing. I am so pleased about that. So we're rebuilding the Paleo Mom, and it's a huge, huge job because again, it's about 2,000 different posts and pages that we're rebuilding from scratch. So it's a huge job and I need my whole team to do it. And while the website is down, I have no way of bringing in money to pay them. So we are crowdfunding the one month of salary that it's and operating expenses that we need to rebuild the site. And so any listeners who would like to contribute, I have an Indiegogo campaign set up. And this is the really cool part, because all of the perks are like my best resources, and your donation to help me rebuild the site that has, you know, been a beacon for our community for so long is actually a great investment in your health, because I've got like tremendous, you're basically getting a huge return on your value with my best resources as a thank you for your donations set up in the Indiegogo perks. But we really need We really need everyone who can to go check out the Indiegogo campaign. I'm assuming you guys put a link in the show notes. Yeah. For anyone who's like at a computer and wants me to spell out the link, it's igg.me/@thepaleomom. And if you go there, you can learn more details about this crazy ransomware attack and, you know, what we're raising, but we really need funds to be able to continue this rebuild. And I'm worried that if we don't raise enough funds, we won't be able to complete the rebuild. And that's kind of a scary prospect for me, one that I try not to think about. And then the idea is once the Paleomom is rebuilt, we will then turn to Nutrivore because we have to rebuild that. And unfortunately, we don't have the benefit of web archives because everything that was built for Nutrivore was still not live on the internet yet. So we'll have to rebuild that as well, which will also be a huge job. But once the Paleomom is going and can, you know, be back to bringing in revenue to pay my team, then that can fund the Nutrivore rebuild. But right now I need whatever help, dear listeners, you can send our way, because it's just a huge job and I can't do this without my team.
Yeah. And we met you a few years ago. You very quickly became one of our favorite people and friends. And we have sent probably almost every patient to your paleomom.com. thepaleomom.com website, because the AIP information, the wealth of knowledge is far beyond anything we could specifically provide our patients.
And myth busting articles. How many like myths have, you know, that tend to make their rounds cyclically through the alternative health community of like things that someone will say is a magic cure is actually a terrible idea. You know, that's always content that is actually, you know, most of my articles, my science articles represent 30 to 40 hours worth of work in research and writing and, you know, and making sure that communication is really clear. So, you know, it's a decade worth of work that just overnight stopped, it exists, but I can't access it. So it might as well not exist is sort of how it feels. So it just feels really important to rebuild because of how many people my work has helped in the past. And if it's back on the internet, it has the capacity to help that many more people and then some in the future. And it feels like it's an important thing to focus on. Whatever help anyone can provide, every little bit counts. And we really can't do this without the community.
So you also have amazing books. So if people go online and buy your books, will that help too?
Yes. Yes. Every single bit helps. So I have 4 imprint books, Paleo Principles, which is basically all the science behind the paleo diet, but also 200, it's a full cookbook too. It's like also 200 recipes and 20 meal plans all in one. The Paleo Approach, which is the definitive guide on the autoimmune protocol, the Paleo Approach cookbook and the Healing Kitchen, which are AIP cookbooks. And you can get those wherever books are sold. So that definitely helps. I've also got some really fun t-shirts that my graphic designer designed.
Radish one.
I saw them. They're cute.
The radish one is definitely like the fan favorite. So it's a very nerdy looking radish. And then it says rad-ish definition, kind of cool underneath. Which by the way, radishes are crazy nutrient dense. They're more nutrient dense than kale. They're one of the highest nutrient density foods you can get at a grocery store. So I think they're totally rad, not just rad-ish, but that's a fun pun. And then we have one, that says heart beat. And then it's a beat that's kind of shaped like a heart. So it's like heart beat, B-E-E-T. And then we have one for the very narrow slice of society that ever said the words on fleek. We have one. If you are exactly a first wave millennial and on fleek was a term that you used up until about 5 years ago, if that's you, we also have one that has a very on fleek leak.
Theoretically, I'm a first wave millennial, but I have never said on fleek until just now.
It's a very because it's like no longer a term that's used. Mm-hmm. And you kind of have to be young enough to have known that that was a term that was used for a while. It's a very narrow demographic for that t-shirt. But well, you can
all
get
of our listeners go buy that one.
All of them. Yes. I have all three of them. I like them all because I've always been a person who prided myself in not at all engaging with contemporary culture, but knowing all of the like phrases.
Same.
So when my kids say phrases, I know exactly what they're talking about, but I don't super know the cultural significance of any of it. If you go to the paleomom.com, like I have a temporary website there now, which will give you links to the Indiegogo. It'll give you links to the t-shirts. There's also a service we're using for donations on there called Buy Me a Coffee. And there's some eBooks on there that you can get for $3. And, you know, again, like every little bit helps. And we really need the community to, you know, support this rebuild. We can't do it without you guys.
Well, time to rally. We can get on board with that. So
I appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much for coming on our podcast today. As always, it was a blast and it was full of insight. And good luck with your campaign.
Oh, thank you so much. I just like nerding out with you guys. So this is extra fun.
Yay. Well, you're always welcome to be on our podcast. So
okay. We'll get another one on the calendar.
Yeah. We will put all the links in our show notes and just drive traffic to you.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to the NutriTots podcast. Be sure to like and follow us on your favorite social media platforms and visit our website at NutriTots.com.